Thank you, Bob. I'm Catherine Lake, in for Amy Guth on the Wind Trust Business Lunch on WGN. I think Amy is making silver rope jewelry in Bali this week and just couldn't get back. The weather was really tricky for her, but I appreciate the chance to sit in on the Wind Trust Business Lunch again, but this time on the weekend, a little more relaxed, a little more casual, some fun topics perhaps. I'll tell you, we're going to talk about the Sears Tower. They're giving up on its own brand name. And Bridget Sweeney did a great story in Cranes about it, and I want to talk with her more about that. We're also going to bring in somebody from Wall Street Journal. Yori Koh writes from one of my favorite newspapers, the Wall Street Journal, as well. Twitter is tweaking their timeline. Now, if you don't know what that means, from Twitter all the way through timeline, you'll want to hear it. And if you do know what I mean, you still might be interested because there are a lot of people who are core users of Twitter who are saying, hey, I use Twitter because I don't want to use Facebook, or I don't want the same things about Facebook happening to Twitter. So if you're among those, stick around. We'll talk about that in the second half of the day. But right now, since we are a business lunch, and there are lots of different ways to have a business, to be a business, to start a business, small businesses, large businesses, one of the businesses can be complete self-employment. You don't have to be making a widget and starting a company. You could stay at home and have a job. What could that be? Lots of options. One of them that I thought of was writer. And one of the kinds of writing that I'm interested in is comedy writing. Now, if you are a fan of The Onion, then this first guest of ours today will be a thrill for you. Scott Dickers is the founding editor of The Onion, and he has now gone back to writing books. He's probably got, what, 24 books out
by
now?
Something like 24 books.
Something like 24 books. Thanks for being with us today.
I'm pleased to be here.
Well, I'm really fascinated to talk about the I'm going to get your mic a little hotter here, too, by the way. There we go. I met you when I was first in Madison in radio, which is, by the way, a job. Comes with a paycheck, insurance, ideally, you know, and that's not what you were doing at the time, which was already beginning The Onion, well into it, writing books. You were completely self-employed, as were the others we played with, Jay Rath, P.S. Mueller, cartoonist as well.
Yep.
And you're a cartoonist as well.
Paid in cash.
Paid in cash.
Often by local advertisers who were laundering cocaine money.
Nice, exactly,
that's
precisely.
That's how The Onion got started.
Yes. And I was envious of the three of you. You and Pete Mueller and Jay Rath and Scott Dickers, you guys were all self-employed, and I still had to work for the man. I had no guts to go off the grid like the three of you did and survive. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about that decision, when it happened, when you graduated college or after college. Did you just decide, yeah, I'm never going to go for the man's work?
Well, it's so funny you talk about it like that, like not having the guts. I don't have the guts to get a real job.
Oh, interesting.
It's, to me, so much safer to be warm and cozy at home in your pajamas and writing than it is to get up early and put on a suit and, you know, say yes, sir, no, sir, to some abhorrent boss.
Oh, it is awful.
Yeah, it's
it
just
can
awful.
Be. It can
and I,
be.
You
awful.
Know, and I have done it. I've done it. I worked at McDonald's.
You did?
Straight out of high school.
Oh, Lord.
And I learned a lot there. I learned a work ethic, which I really didn't have. I was pretty lazy.
Being on time.
Yeah, you learn how to be efficient and how to be on time and how to be clean, you know, make use of every second. They're just such a well-run business. I mean, you know, that people have written books about them as a model of the freelance, I'm sorry, of the entrepreneurial effort. Start a business and grow it.
So that's
McDonald's.
two different
who's
things.
Done it better?
Yeah,
who's
right.
done it better?
Right, that is a good model, exactly.
It's a great model. The E-Myth is one of my favorite books, and he goes into great length about McDonald's and their rule book, that it's a system. And so any freelancer, you know, wanting to start something, even if they want to be more than a freelancer, they want to start a company and have employees, having a system that you can write down and share with people is critical.
Interesting.
The biggest problem that most people who work for themselves have is they do all the work themselves.
First of all.
And so they're married to their business. They can't take a vacation. They can't have a personal life.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very common story.
Although that sounds like a recipe for success, too, because
it
like
can be.
When I was deciding whether or not to be a musician, I should have asked myself a little more fervently, do you, because I didn't, and I went to school for the violin performance. What a hilarious thing.
Very
that was.
Lucrative.
Yeah, very lucrative, first of all.
Major.
And second of all, if you can do something else, if there's something that distracts you from that, do that.
Do the thing. And because, people get into the thing they love.
Yes.
That's the path. And that's one half of it. You have to have that passion for doing what you're doing.
Not just passion, singular passion.
Oh, yeah. Obsessive,
right? Obsessive passion.
That's critical. If you don't have that, you're probably not laying a good foundation for any kind of career. But on the other hand, you also have to be able to delegate and scale. Because if you're just so passionately obsessed that you're doing all the work yourself, you're never going to grow and you're never going to move out of that, you know, one person maybe making 100K a year cap.
That must have been very difficult when you were beginning The Onion, because the voice of The Onion is very specific.
Yes.
I tried to write for The Onion a few times when I knew you then. I was your business manager for a couple of years, but that's about as close as I got. A couple of movie reviews I think I did. But other than that, they would just pat me on the head and say, yeah, it's not quite it yet, but keep trying.
Right.
And you did that to a lot of people. Teaching, delegating, like you say.
Yeah.
Difficult.
Which I'm now doing again at the Second City. You know, we teach these Writing with the Onion classes where we teach people how to write comedy in prose, you know, how mm-hmm. to actually write the written word and make it funny, which is a real skill. And at The Onion, we kind of created this business out of training people to write a certain comedic voice.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it would have been impossible. And believe me, I did it at first. For the first, you know, 2 or 3 years that I was at The Onion, I wrote almost everything.
You did.
And I was there till 3 a.m. every morning. We'd get up and go right into the office. I mean, it was the typical story of the obsessed passion. And so in order to scale, you have to get other people in. And I think one good way to do that is to, especially if you're in a media industry like a newspaper, we're distributing it free on the street in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
So people are seeing it and they're liking it and they're knocking on our door and they're saying, hey, can I help? And that's beautiful, because what you get is you get people just like you.
Yes.
Who are so passionate about comedy that they will knock on a door and say, hey, I really want to do this. And you'll tell them, you know what, I can't pay anything. And they're like, I don't care.
That's the guy. That's the person
it's like
you want.
Every one of them who said that, I was like, you're hired.
Yeah.
And that's how easy it was to get a job as an Onion writer in those days. And so
was it easy to train them?
Well, that was the that was the more challenging part, is training them.
Yeah.
So I think when people are that eager and are willing to just jump in with 2 feet and not get paid and work slave labor for nothing for years, they have to have that enough passion that you can tell them, you know what, this isn't really working that well. If you did it more like this, it'd be great. That would crush most people.
Yeah.
Like when you do a creative work and somebody doesn't like it, that's people just die inside and that's they can't take it.
Mm.
And so they don't try. But the people who have enough chutzpah to try and can take that, they're absolutely, those are the ones that succeed.
So chutzpah and taking criticism, moving past
adapting
it.
Adapting the criticism
adapting
and improving
it.
Your work as a result. That's
very,
you have to do that.
Well, I want you to talk me off the ledge, because I think everybody has a fantasy that they can write a book. Who doesn't have a children's book?
Oh, yeah.
In
and everybody's a comedian.
Oh.
Everybody's got a great idea for The Onion.
It's just rainbows, butterflies, and unicorns. I can write this. Yes,
right.
Absolutely.
It's so easy. Yeah.
It's so
if it's
easy.
So easy, why aren't you Tina Fey?
Well, thank you. And
I wasn't talking to you. I was talking to the listener.
Well, we're going to dive more into this, because he does have a new book out. Scott Dickers, founding editor of The Onion, has also brought in Brian Sweeney. We're going to get back with you, Brian, and introduce you as well, because I think he's following your passion. And he's a part of this new book that you have coming out. I don't even have the title in front of me, so I'm not going to promote that. But we're going to take a quick break and come back with more with Scott Dickers, the founding editor of The Onion and self-employed entrepreneurship on 720 WGN.
So we'll see if we can get Mr. Perot on the line and wish him a happy birthday. It's a good thing it's a local call.
Hello, Ross Perot. You want to join the Ross Perot organization?
Oh, good morning, Mr. Perot. Thank
good
you.
Good morning.
It's Catherine Lake calling. I just called to wish you a happy birthday and
yeah,
to find
in fact,
out...
Catherine, it's not a happy birthday, you see, because I'm not a happy man.
Oh,
because I'm not the President of the United States.
I realize
see, and
that.
And the tail that wags a dog saves two in the bush.
Yeah. Well, I'm just calling to wish you a happy birthday to find out what you're doing with your time lately, because I know
that
you...
What am I doing with my time? Well, I'm wishing I was the President of the United States.
Oh, yeah.
I'm bugging the President of the United States. Like a little mosquito.
Oh, you are?
That's what I'm doing with my time. I'm bugging him.
Because
he's doing things on this NAFTA thing, on this healthcare thing, on the Haiti thing. I don't like it.
You don't like
it? So
anything?
I'm calling up like a little mosquito. 24 hours a day, just doing a little mosquito.
You're actually...
I call him. I might do that to him several hours a day. That's what I do with my time.
That's all you're doing of
tonight. That's right. So today's my birthday. I'm going to give myself a little gift and call him up and do it a little extra longer.
Look at that noise. That's a good... That's bugging them, I'm sure. I'm sure that bugs them a lot.
Ah, from the good old days. Just proving that I've known Scott Dickers for many years, he graced me on the air on a radio show I had in Madison and would call me as George Bush, Sr., and Ross Perot, and now joining us here in the studio, Scott Dickers, founding editor of The Onion, now back to his roots of writing, cartoonist as well. But and is there any of your cartoons in here? No, probably not.
There's a lot of art.
A lot of art.
Photoshop mashups and illustrations. It's a very graphical book.
This book being called Trump's America, The Complete Loser's Guide. I cannot wait to read this book cover to cover. It really is stuffed.
You need to read it.
I do.
Because your guidebook for when Trump becomes president.
Right.
Everything you need to know is in there.
Excellent.
So this will be required reading throughout the campaign and after he's inevitably elected.
Inevitably, because he will be with that hair.
He wins.
And of course he does. not immune to rewriting history. There are a lot of books put out by Scott Dickers personally and by The Onion collectively under his guidance, not the least of which is The Complete History.
Our Dumb Century.
Our Dumb Century, The Complete History of the United States. And that was a book that started me off on just adoring anything that you guys put out. It's a great book.
Yeah, Trump's America retells future history.
Future history, very
good.
We
lay out his whole next 4, 8, or possibly more years
in
office.
We've been talking a lot about, in the first segment here, about being a self-employed person. And you have brought another self-employed person with you because in your capacity as an instructor in writing at Second City, Brian Sweeney has been one of your proteges.
There are a lot of other writers on this book. I was the editor of the book and one of the writers. And Brian is one of a great team of writers that all coalesced in this class at the Second City Training Center called the Onion Masterclass. These are people that had gone through all 4 levels of the Onion classes and really honed their skills as comedy writers and did an amazing job. It's a super funny book. Super proud of it.
Trump's America, The Complete Loser's Guide, available now, Amazon, I presume?
Yeah, wherever you buy books. Unless you're a caveman and you buy it at a bookstore, we kind of had to rush it to press.
Yes.
It'll be in bookstores, but it's not quite there yet.
Timing. How long ago did you start the process on this book?
4 months ago.
That's it?
It was, and I hesitate to, I mean, I hasten to add, the creative process was not rushed.
No.
But getting it to press was
rushed. Was really rushed.
It's like we finished copy editing and it was in our hands in like less than a week.
So anybody can write a book and self-publish it. It can't necessarily be good, but everybody needs to know if you're going to write a book that it does take other people. It is a collaborative effort, whether or not you know it, whether or not your name is the only one in the book. As it happens, this one has a lot of names, including Brian Sweeney. Did that surprise you, Brian, that you learned that every book takes a lot of people? And a particular book like this, when it's governed by a man who put The Onion together with a crowd of people that he trained, did that take you by surprise at all?
Well, Scott had explained how The Onion works and things like that. But it didn't really. I figured that it would take a huge amount of people, but I've obviously been, for things like The Onion, I've grew up in the area, the Chicagoland area, so it's always been around from the first time most people see The Onion. Well, not anymore, but at one point when it was just a newspaper, they might see it and then think it's like real and then say like, is this not real?
I remember that day
when
I first saw it in Madison, Wisconsin in a little store. Yeah.
My first one was about people passing out at a Fish concert due to smell. And my friend had it and I was like, is this real? And he's like, I don't know.
It was questionable.
Yeah. But anyway, yes. And then obviously there's been such the writer's room and things like that are a big thing for comedy writing, and I've been doing comedy stuff for a while.
Talk a little bit about the process of this particular book and putting it together with all the people that you put it together with.
We it was originally not supposed to be really a book. It was a smaller thing, but then when we started doing it, Scott had said,
"This is a book.
I'm going to try to make this a book because this is really."
It was more of an exercise at first, perhaps.
Well, it was supposed to be like the final sort of project,
and
it would
okay.
go like on a website.
Uh-huh.
But then, as the people in this program are incredible, the writing seriously is. This is a project that I am fine with asking people and my friends to pay money for.
Of course.
Because it, like, it's, I don't feel shame. I honestly feel this is worth your time.
Absolutely.
And money. And so it started with that, and as things kept going on, and then it's, there was just so much, that was the big thing. There's a tremendous amount of material that gets written and written and written, and almost all of it is left to the side. Probably 80-90% of the stuff that we wrote throughout the weeks and weeks that we went through this, of like, and it does become an arduous process. I'm not saying it's like ditch digging or anything
like
that.
Well, no, like other arts, though, and to compare it to the fine arts, it's more like sculpting than like paint, because you're more taking away, right? You're more culling, taking away everything that isn't the sculpture.
Yes, and even up until like the last second, Scott would email us and say, you know, this one joke isn't working, and then say like, and then he would say, so send me 10 jokes
that replace
by
this.
The end of the day.
He would nix one and ask for 10 to replace it.
He would, yeah, but I mean, it was 10 out of the 15 or 20 people we have working, so hopefully one would show up that was good, and so that's the type of, that's like the quality process that is being worked on, and that's why Scott Dickers, I mean, is okay with having his name on the book,
You want to talk about it with him right now, because he's here, as it turns out.
What? Oh, hey, hello, Brian. Scott. Hey, aren't you the Ross Perot guy?
Go ahead.
It's very similar to the process at The Onion, where hundreds of jokes are generated for the, you know, couple of dozen that will be run on the website every day. And so, you know, that's a system that I developed and created, and so it's the only system I know. And it is, sculpting is a great analogy, because sometimes you have a story that's pretty good, but me, I'm a tough room. Mm. I don't laugh at a lot of stuff. Mm-mm. So for something to be really funny to me, I think this is what has made me a good editor over the years, is that I have really high standards, and something has to be really amazingly great and funny for me to say, oh, yeah, that's funny.
Is it wrong of me to say that that characteristic of you, that you don't easily laugh, I could compare you, and don't take this too seriously, but to David Letterman, my husband is a comedian. The ones who aren't so easily made to laugh are among the funniest people I know. What is with that?
It's because we have to work so much harder to find the laughs. And so
it's a work.
The stuff that we're finding that's making us funny is probably like super turbocharged funny for the regular person.
Yes.
And boy, I remember when The Onion first started to get famous, people started to discover it. We would get letters from people saying, oh my God, I used to be depressed, and then I started reading The Onion. I'm just laughing so much.
Aww.
I'm so happy. Or I went off my antidepressant meds.
That's what you want
to
hear.
I've been reading The Onion. You know, it was amazing to hear that stuff. And then other people would say, did you call it The Onion because you knew that it was so funny that people would be crying? And I'm like, oh my God, if we had that much chutzpah to actually know that, that would be amazing.
That would have been nice.
But no. So, and it all comes from that sculpting analogy, where you have this idea in your head of, okay, this could be really funny. What's it going to take for it to be funnier? Well, let's chip away from here. Let's add to here. And that's a winnowing process that, you know, takes a little while, but you end up with stuff that is pretty, you know, supercharged funny.
Supercharged funny. Trump's America, The Complete Loser's Guide. The latest from Scott Dickers, founding editor of The Onion, and a large cadre of people he has been teaching at Second City. In case you're interested in The Onion way of writing, I suppose one could still sign
you
up for that
course.
You can
sign up for classes. I teach many of them. There are also excellent teachers who work at The Onion, who teach people the system, the Onion writing system.
Very good.
Yeah, so that, you know, yeah, this book, it it felt important. Didn't feel like we were getting the proper satirical humor response to Trump that we should as a culture.
That's real. I don't think the media is allowed to in a lot of ways, because a lot of people do take him quite seriously as a candidate. Duh.
Yeah, or the jokes seem, you know, just sort of lighthearted, or like late night talk shows are just having a little fun with his hair or whatever. But
this is a pretty serious.
It felt like, you know, there is some real humor here. This is a serious guy and a serious situation that deserves a really high quality humor treatment.
Do you mind if we give away a couple of these books?
You should give away a couple of those books. A
couple
That'd be great.
Of those books. How about the? I mean, the people who are interested in the first couple of callers, really, 312-981-7200. if you'd like one of these books, please. That's really nice. Thank
there
you
is
so
a responsibility
much.
That comes from winning a free book, though.
Oh, what is that?
I'm not making the rules. I'm just throwing this out there.
Yep.
If you get a book for free, you got to make like 10 friends buy one. Because we're not, you know, nobody paid us to write this book.
No, I hear
so
you.
We're selling it. You know, we need to make money. Back to our original topic of conversation.
Yes.
Making money without getting a computer printed paycheck from a big company.
Very good.
Everybody, you know, who put their months and months of work into this book did it for no money, yep. including myself.
Okay.
And we're splitting the earnings.
Very nice.
And so far the response has been amazing. We're selling a ton of them. We just got a huge order from a distributor that we honestly don't even know how we're going to fill, because now we have to pay for the we have to come up with like tens of thousands of dollars
to get the
to
books
print
out.
The books.
Yes, yes, okay.
But they're going to sell, and so it's going to be a good investment, and ultimately proved to be a very wise choice as a business to
yep.
go into.
Yep. Scott Dickers, founding editor of The Onion and a co-writer, one of the many. Brian Sweeney, thank you very much for your time here on WGN. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I am Catherine Lake, in for Amy Goof. She's off to Brazil to help finish the Olympic Stadium Village.
Seems to change every hour what she's doing.
Really? I didn't notice that. But she's a very busy woman.
She's a busy lady.
She's a very busy lady. Hey, Bob and Griffin, I need your help with this next business here. You need to be part of this. By the way, I'm Catherine Lake, in for Amy Goof on the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. If I say to you, Bob, for instance, name the first three things to come to mind when I say the brand REI, for instance. Positive things you might think of.
Hiking boots, tents, sleeping bag.
Nice. The best of all of those, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. How about, Griffin, how about Nike?
Shoes. Michael Jordan.
Good shoes, right?
Yep.
Okay, now back to you, Bob. How about Sears?
Craftsman Tools, maybe?
Terrific. That's okay. Not bad. That's
yeah.
a brand.
Sears. What else do they? I guess clothes?
I guess.
Yeah.
Kind of haven't been there in a while. I haven't been there
in years. Closed the one on State Street, you know?
Uh-huh. That's ironic, because I was just going to say I went to the one on State Street in Boston when I was in college in the late 80s. But that's probably the last time I went to a Sears.
I have an air conditioning unit that I bought in 2013, and I did get it on the State Street Sears.
Very good. So but electronics,
that was about it, yeah.
Sure. They were, you know, the washing machines, they were the standard bearer for a lot of things for
yeah.
a very long time. And the person who knows...
Kenmore, weren't they the Kenmore place?
Kenmore, yeah. Sears Kenmore, yes. And the person who knows most about this right now is a Cranes writer, Bridget Sweeney, who's on the phone with us right now. Bridget, thank you for your time.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I found this a very fascinating article that Griffin found for me, actually, that they're giving up on its own brand name and what that means exactly, the value of their name. They took it off the Sears Tower. They had to.
Absolutely. But what they're doing now actually has more to do with atoning. Like, they have to do that. Companies have to test the value of their brand in the marketplace every year. And clearly, as you guys just showed by your little game of association, the value of Sears in the marketplace and to consumers has just fallen precipitously over the years.
That's a very interesting distinction that you made in the first part of what you just said, which is that they must do this annually. They most, if not all companies must, but it's not something that they normally make really public. It's more for their internal workings. Is that correct?
It's a non-cash thing, so it's not actually on the books, but they do. They are required to do it every year.
A perception check of the public's view of themselves.
Absolutely,
okay.
Absolutely. It relates back to actually acquisitions. It's generally a way for companies who pay too much for an overvalued, acquisition to kind of say, "Hey, we paid too much. This isn't worth what it was when we bought it." So this actually goes back to when the Sears CEO, Eddie Lampert, created the current Sears holding company by combining Kmart and Sears. So at that time, more than a decade ago, Sears name was valued much higher than
it
is today.
Because he took out Kmart, which was a probably very big competitor. So he took them out and he thought, well, there we go. Now we're the only name, the standard bearer.
Right. And
okay.
He thought, hey, I have these two huge retailers, I'm going to make something amazing. And that clearly has not come to pass.
I wonder, is there something to the idea that he shouldn't have thought that way. Here I am. I'm a radio announcer in Chicago. I'm making a whole lot less than the CEO of Sears, no matter how bad Sears is right now, that he should have taken that iconic name for 100+ years and banked on that heritage, even for millennials or the new generations. He should have banked on the old rather than saying, well, we just took out a competitor. We're fine.
Right. Well, and the business press over the years has had just a field day beating up Eddie Lampert for all the ways he's messed up this retailer. Mm. Back in the day, he was considered to be the next Warren Buffett. He was this hotshot, Wall Street guy, very smart guy. The view among many watchers is that his hubris has kind of prevented him from saving the company. He's at the beginning, he slashed the amount of money that he spent maintaining stores.
Ah.
To him, it didn't make sense. He's not a retailer. He doesn't love the touch and feel of these stores. I don't think he has any emotional attachment to the history of Sears.
That's huge.
And so, yeah. And so the stores, as any Chicagoan can attest to, for a combination of factors, there wasn't money spent in keeping them looking nice. Clearly, times changed. Sears didn't really keep up. A lot of other competitors, Lowe's, Home Depot, places that sold just as many washers and dryers, just as many tools, and started offering better prices and better service.
Mm.
It just became kind of a perfect storm of issues that have just eaten Sears alive over the past, 15 years.
Is there any element of the too big to fail idea for banks that we couldn't allow them to fail? Businesses that get too big to succeed and then have to sort of crush themselves down to try and retool like Sears seems to be doing, closing stores and rethinking what they've done in the past. Is there an element of that to this, that the new era is, hey, you're too big, I don't want to shop with you?
Well, absolutely, for retailers, and that can be kind of interpreted in several different ways. Mm. From a physical perspective, these big stores are certainly too large. I mean, you see Walmart creating smaller stores. You see pretty much you see Target creating these, smaller express and city stores.
If only to give the idea of intimacy and personalization.
Well, exactly. And also because they realize people are increasingly, even if they're shopping through Target and Walmart.com, they're buying online. They don't need these mega 100,000 square foot, huge big box stores that, blanketed the suburbs for decades. And now all of a sudden, people are moving back to the city. They're ordering stuff online, having it delivered for free. These companies don't need these huge stores with all this inventory.
Very interesting. So Sears giving up on its own brand name, devaluing the name Sears in their internal marketing decision making, and it's going to be something to continue to watch to see if Sears can survive this latest downturn in their own business.
It's a sad story.
It is. It is. Bridget Sweeney, thank you so much from Cranes. Really appreciate it. Keep up that great work.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you
Take
so
care.
Much. The Wintrust Business Lunch with Amy Guth. I am Catherine Lake, in for Amy. And we're going to come back and talk with a great author from the Wall Street Journal, Yori Koh, who did a really interesting story about Twitter tweaking their timeline. I know it sounds like maybe if you're not a tweeter that you don't need to worry about it, but I think you do, and you'll find out why in just a moment on WGN. The Wintrust Business Lunch with Amy Guth. I am not Amy. I'm Catherine Lake. Amy's still off today, but she's allowed me to sit in her chair here on 720 WGN, and I thank you for staying with us. We are going to talk about Twitter just a little bit here. Yori Koh from the Wall Street Journal is with us, and he has written a fascinating article about Twitter tweaking their timeline. Now, if you are not a Twitter user, I think you still very much should be listening to this because it affects all social media, and social media affects all business, whether you believe it or not. Do you think I've couched that correctly, Yori?
Sure.
Sure.
One of the things about Twitter is that it has is a very big microphone. So if something gets said on Twitter and if it's of a certain amount of importance, it gets spread around very quickly.
Even quicker than a Facebook? Would you compare it?
Well, so one of the things that Twitter's unique strength is its real-time speed. And that, for sure, even today, is much better and much more effective than Facebook. So if you want something out there right away and you want people to notice it right away, it's better to go to Twitter than to Facebook.
Okay, so it is more of an in-the-moment thing. But they are now adding something to the timeline. So when I go to Facebook, it has already been sort of organized for me, if I've got this correct. And the algorithms change all the time, I realize, and advertising plays a role in all that as well. But in general, if I focus on, click on, deal with a friend's post often, or if I check in their page often, it'll come onto Facebook's feed for me. Now, Twitter has historically been just a little different. You hop on the Twitter feed, things are going by pretty quickly. They're all live, real time, a variety of people. They don't algorithm up people you are, well, they might. Maybe I'm misspeaking in that because I do follow some people on Twitter and those people are in my feed. But beyond that, they don't evaluate the quality, if I'm correct. So correct me on that if I'm not right. And then, and if you will, expand on what they're going to do to change that.
Right. So Twitter has historically, and their signature has been this reverse chronological order where everything shows up by recency. The most recent tweet will show up at the top of your feed, and then you scroll down back through time in your timeline. And that's great because it's an easy way to keep things organized. But the downside is that, you know, not all tweets are created equal. Not every single tweet is of great importance or of huge relevance or of interest to you. So people can get bored or things get lost in that mix. And so Twitter is basically, with this change, trying to help users see the more interesting tweets first. But I have to emphasize here that they are not changing their actual basic timeline. So it would basically be that when you were to open up the app again, you will be shown a list of your the best tweets that you missed while you were gone. And it could go up to a dozen or so of those tweets. And then if you pull to refresh, it'll take you back to your live timeline. So it's not that they're getting rid of what they have had in the past. They're just adding on to it.
It's very ethereal, this concept of how they judge these moments and which ones are being received by the most people and being retweeted. I mean, it is all algorithms, but this change has gotten a few of their core users a little worried.
I have to say that a lot of that worry came out before the actual announcement, and I think some of the leaks that had come out about the announcement were a little inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
People assumed, basically, if you use the word algorithm and Twitter in one sentence, people will freak out.
Yes,
and
yes.
That's what happened in this instance. But, you know, algorithms can mean very different things. And in this case, yes, they are applying an algorithm, but it's an addition to the Twitter experience, not replacing the traditional Twitter experience.
They're just trying to do a little more of the sifting of the gold, as I think the CEO put it. They're trying to do a little more of the sifting of the gold for you. And this is all in an effort to get more users to Twitter, right?
Right. Although this change is more targeted towards the core users, their biggest fans on the service, according to when their head product guy talked to me, he said this is actually not necessarily to get new users on board. It's to make the Twitter experience better for those who are already on it. And then once those people have a better experience, they will then, by word of mouth, tell their friends and family.
Is that something that people who are invested in Twitter are concerned about? Because it sounds like a long-term solution that will it will grow. It will grow. He's trying to grow his base in order to grow Twitter, more people on the base, but also bringing in new people, like you say, self-advertising. But is the board, the people who are invested, saying, hey, just get me some new people. We just need more bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, so to be honest, I was a little surprised when he said that this was geared towards core users, because quite frankly, Twitter has a lot of problems right now, and keeping their core users on board is not one of them. The people who like Twitter like it a lot and will stick around. They have stuck around despite the shortcomings in the product. What they have to be focusing on is how to get new users. I asked that question to the head of consumer product, Jeff Seibert, this last week, and he said, you know, we can be working on more than one thing at a time.
Yes.
What's interesting about Twitter and what we'll see is that they have tried a lot of different product changes. Some have worked, some have not. I think that they're just going to continue to try out different things and see what sticks.
And do you have any idea what those spitball ideas might be? I mean, I'm not a tweeter. I have an account. I own one, so to speak, but I don't use it a lot. I will more readily check in with Facebook. I promoted today being on the air on Facebook. I did not tweet it, idiot. But what kinds of things can Twitter, can you even tell me what kinds of things they're thinking they'll do to bring people into tweeting?
Actually, you might be a better person to answer that question because, I mean, what would make you want to use Twitter more often or tweet more often?
I think that's a big question
that they well, that's what they have to figure out. And I think some of that is they have to reduce these challenges on once you get into Twitter, how to get them really a part of the Twitter experience very quickly. I think it's a lot more intuitive with Facebook. With Facebook, you're connected to your friends and family. On Twitter, who are you connected to?
Theoretically, the world. Theoretically.
Yes, yes.
But they have to follow you. See, even the details of how Twitter works, similar to Facebook, occasionally go over my head because I don't know if my tweet will hit the world or just the people who have followed me. I suppose it'll hit everybody if the people who followed me retweet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you, Yuri. You put a little light on the subject of Twitter and the fact that they are changing their timeline, but just a bit, just tweaking it, as it were. And thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Yuri, from the Wall Street Journal. And we are going to take a quick break. I am Catherine Lake, in for Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch.